Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. We're recording this on March 30th, 2017, and this is episode 26. It's our six-month anniversary. Politicoast is the podcast that explores what's happening in British Columbia and across the country. We're a proud partner of the darkhorse.report. If you haven't already, please make sure to subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or wherever you found this podcast. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at PoliticoastPod.
I'm Scott.
And I'm Ian. So last night, we had some fun. We hung out with Barry from Glacier Media over at the This Is Lotus Land podcast. And if people follow us on Twitter, they'll have seen that we were bragging about our interviews with David Eby, local NDP MLA, and the BC Green Party communications coordinator, Ryan Clayton. And both of those interviews will be coming out in the next couple of weeks. We're also hoping to secure an interview with the BC Liberal MLA, hopefully in the next week. And those full interviews will trickle out on This Is Lotus Land sort of throughout the election. And we're going to take some of the best bits of that and put it in probably future episodes. We thought this was going to be a quiet week, and then we found so much content. So we'll try and keep this to a manageable level. So let's just jump right in. Segment one, hitting the housing reset button. The city of Vancouver this week looked at the first step of its housing reset report that Gregor Robertson is trying to use to bring about a solution to the housing crisis, and you seem disappointed.
He gets it right in that there's, you know, a need for big policy changes, but this report is kind of a little lackluster in how it approaches the issue and kind of just how it deals with some of the underlying problems of the housing market. So just for a little context, this is kind of the initial report, and there's going to be some consultation periods before the final housing reset actually happens. The broad themes is to link housing affordability targets to income, create more of the right supply, complete neighborhoods with new housing forms, provide city land to increase affordable housing, and prioritize affordable housing delivery.
So they went through and did a lot of sort of pre-consultations with people, sort of asked them, what's wrong? And then they also got Ernst & Young to get some actual data on who can afford homes and all that kind of thing. And what they suggest in this report is the supply for the well-off is actually doing decently. If you're making over $50,000 a year as an individual, you aren't totally priced out of the housing market. But once you're under $50,000, there's just no supply. There's nothing affordable in Vancouver. And that matches sort of general experience. Maybe not quite the $50,000. Maybe if you're over $150,000, at least as a couple, but they suggest the solution is to basically play around with the supply that's coming out and try to switch from this sort of market that wants to sell the richest, most expensive possible houses to the people who can afford them, which tends to be investors, whether they're domestic or foreign, and try to rebalance the market in a way that brings more affordable housing online, maybe fills in some of the gaps, because we have a decreasing number of single-family homes and we have lots of condos, but there's not that townhouse or what they call missing middle.
What is the missing middle, but they incorrectly use the term for something else. And that goes to one of my main complaints on this, is they apparently don't know what some fairly basic terms are. They misuse missing middle, which generally refers to those kind of medium density, not the towers, not single-family housing, to use it to refer to kind of the mid-market between subsidized affordable housing and, you know, the new expensive stuff that's coming on the market, and we're kind of the very high current market prices.
Yeah, when I was going through the report, I definitely saw it put in that frame, the sort of there's no housing for people who aren't poor but aren't rich, sort of middle class almost. So they said it's a missing middle.
Yeah.
And that you're right, when you go to missingmiddle.com or whatever the main housing report, it's all about we need dense housing. I'll push back because there was one slide in the presentation they gave to council, because that's the other thing I skimmed through, because reading dense council reports is boring as hell. And they did actually steal the image from missingmiddle.com or whatever it was. So they are aware of the definition you're
almost
talking
makes
about.
Makes it worse.
Well, but I think what they were trying to get at is those are the houses they think middle-class people can buy.
Yeah.
But we don't have them. So they sort of like skipped a step.
Yeah, actually bringing in the real missing middle will help their idea of what the missing middle is for sure. But it's a little worrying they aren't using kind of basic terminology in the field correctly. Externality was another one they just kind of butchered, where they use it to refer to basically anything outside the jurisdiction of the city or the province or anything, rather than its more precise definition of a cost not borne by the participants in a particular economic transaction. We've talked a fair bit about carbon pricing, for example, because that's an externality where some sort of economic activity is causing problems for a third party that isn't involved in the bit of economic activity there.
Yeah, the focus of this report is really to just try to figure out what can the city do? What are the tools at the city's disposal and that they can, what levers can they pull to try to solve these? And that's one of the criticisms that NPA Councillor Melissa DeGenovo brought forward. She said, why isn't Gregor Robertson on the phone with the Premier and the Housing Minister getting involved in this affordable home ownership program and finding ways to work with the province? I mean, that might be a little bit disingenuous, I think, because I don't see this province also trying to reach out. She's also talking about like convincing the provincial government to change the Vancouver Charter to give them more powers. And again, I don't see the political will at the provincial level to do that.
Yeah, that's definitely true. But at the same time, Gregor Robertson's relationship with the provincial government could definitely be strained at times. And you know, right now, Vision Vancouver is in the middle of a tweet campaign kind of aimed at the government. So I'm not sure this necessarily meshes with picking up the phone and trying to do a lot of that backroom working on this
yeah,
sort of thing.
Vision Vancouver is definitely more aligned with the BC NDP. The NPA is aligned with the BC Liberals. So of course the NPA councillor is like, well, I could just call my friends in cabinet, right? Why can't you do that? I'm obviously exaggerating a bit, but the hostility is definitely real. This is the BC Liberal government that fired the Vision Vancouver dominated school board because they didn't pass the budget that they had to. So there's bad blood there for sure. But overall, this report is really just trying to talk about the 9,500 rental homes that we need to really fill the lower income gaps. And in each of those sort of priorities you talked about, there's a lot of sort of vague initial, it's a very preliminary report, I think. It's the sort of big initial ideas of, you know, we need to be a bit more dense here. Some of these things we've been doing are working. It didn't really identify anything that's not working. Like, it talks about how the city is halfway through its homelessness plan, but didn't really point out that they've not had any success on that file.
They did mention that the average time to get a zoning change and building permit issued is 73 weeks, I believe, which, you know, that's more than a year and a half. So this is to the point where it's just kind of ridiculous if you want to actually get anything built. You're waiting more than a year from the time you file the paperwork to the time you even just get the initial building permit and zone application. We can start putting shovels in the ground to get new housing projects on the go. And, you know, this is a constant source of annoyance for anyone who's actually trying to build housing. And they do want to bring it down to 35 weeks, which, you know, it's less than a year, but that's still a long time for land that could be having housing built on it to just kind of sit there unused.
But you got to start somewhere. You can't just go from 70 weeks to two, but maybe that's just being charitable. One thing the report did also highlight is, and tried to really play up, was the number of housing starts this last year in 2016 was actually up significantly over the past, like, decade average, which seems more like an outlier than any trend. The data was pretty noisy there, but then suddenly housing starts were up. That compares to the supply curve that has just sort of slowly increased over time.
It's building permits. They, without actually having buildings there, it's a little harder to get a sense of it. And yeah, so it's a start, but at the same time, this is really kind of behind where we should be on this sort of thing. And that's one of my big problems with this, is they talk a fair bit in the report on how they're going to be kind of meeting the future demand, but they don't put a lot of emphasis on kind of the pent-up demand that's already there. Like, at their projected supply requirements are basically just going off of the population, projected population increase, but that doesn't account for, you know, the people who are staying away from Vancouver because it's too expensive, or, you know, people like me who I have a couple of roommates, and, you know, if housing was half of what it is now, I probably wouldn't. So you also need to account for the elasticity of supply, and that doesn't really seem to be in there at all.
It definitely highlights at least that young people are leaving, that the number of young children in Vancouver has declined, even while the population has gone up. It has declined in absolute values, like from 24,000 to 22,000 over roughly over a decade, while the city has grown. So it highlights some of the problems, but yeah, if they shift affordable housing in, obviously people are going to want to come back from Coquitlam and the Valley and elsewhere back into the city of Vancouver. And one of the sort of more wishful thinkings I think I saw in there was this idea that they can achieve a lot by just sort of negotiating with developers, saying, we don't have the levers to force developers necessarily, but we can say, let's try and make sure you sell some of your units at cheaper, which would be nice for everyone who wants to buy a cheaper home, but...
That's it's a policy known as inclusionary zoning, which is a bit of an oxymoron since zoning is by its nature exclusionary. But with that, what it does is you basically, you know, require to sell so many units below market rate, or you get a slight increase in your density as a result of being including below market units. But the big problem with that is it's effectively just increases the cost of every other non-subsidized unit there, because it's a unit subsidy and it's basically being paid for by the market rate housing on there. So that reduces the margins on a project, and consequently it shifts the, you know, where the marginal unit that gets built is, and that the net result is you reduce supply overall, because yeah, some people get this nice below market housing, but the end result is less housing gets built overall.
It's a challenge that's faced sort of by every major city. Like, you see ridiculous housing prices in New York, which has tried, I think, everything to get it under control, from rent control to all of these ideas and more. And some are still around.
Yeah, New York, though, has kind of the similar problems that we in San Francisco do, in that they've underbuilt for their population growth for a long time now.
And I guess just the point is, it's not like there's a clear, simple solution. I think this report, it has its heart in the right place, for at least me, but I guess it's going to be more interesting to see where it comes out in July when they get around through their engagement and their analysis and come out with their final copy.
I mean, I'll give them credit for at least identifying kind of where some of the major problems are, but in terms of the proposed solutions, they're pretty lackluster and kind of tiptoeing around any broad reforms to this. Like, they're all, you know, we're going to do a little upzoning in kind of these small parts of the city. Like, if you look on the map they include in the report, it's not a huge amount of the overall city land that they're looking at increasing the density in. And when 70% of the area of Vancouver is zoned for single family residences, this, you know, spot zoning increases mostly along the Canada line. Is that necessarily going to be enough? And that, I think, is the big thing they really miss here, is that they only kind of touch on kind of a little bit of kind of the zoning reform on there and some incentives to increase affordable options, but they aren't looking at kind of the broader wide-scale reform on how we deal with land use in the city. And you know, that is what I think is probably going to be needed. And they just kind of, I guess, are stuck in kind of the City of Vancouver Planning Department mindset and aren't really looking to branch out of that. And that's what I think is largely disappointing about this report.
Well, it's also the kind of frustratingly centrist, like, don't want to go into the liberalize it and just let the market try to solve it, or into the full, like, let's just invest a whole bunch of government money and build a bunch of stuff ourselves. They're trying to play both sides and trying not to do too much because they don't actually have a lot of money to do this, and kind of goes, it won't hurt a lot, but it's just gonna like keep the problem growing, I guess.
Well, that's the beauty of liberalizing it, though, is, you know, Bay Street has a whole bunch of money they can invest in building this. But part of the problem is, like we were talking about, it takes more than 70 weeks to get something approved. It's, you have to fight with every, you know, neighborhood group that doesn't like a new project put in. And the end result of this is a huge amount of the final project costs get spent before the first shovel ever hits the ground. And that leads to the situation where you only build high-end housing because high-end housing is the only profitable thing to build in such a costly regulatory structure. So overall, give it a D in that they kind of identify the broad idea, but they get some basic terminology wrong. They missed kind of anything beyond kind of, I guess, the safe little tweaks that Gregor Robertson likes to make on these sorts of things. And I guess they lack vision.
For how much developer money is going into the municipal political parties here, you'd almost expect them to be more ambitious in the opening up to development. But while we're sort of in the housing mindset, another story that came out this week is the Auditor General released a report on sort of BC housing and the nonprofit asset transfer program have that. Basically, BC housing is the social housing arm of the government. They own a bunch of low-income housing places that people have to apply for, but then owe rent on. What the Auditor General was looking at is, how is the government selling off these? Because it's a BC Liberal government, center-right, they like selling off government assets. The subheading of the report was pretty much, province selling social housing without establishing value for money. And this was a scathing report that just basically said the government doesn't really care and is just getting rid of things as fast as they can without actually trying to get the best value. That just doesn't make sense, I think, from any other than like an ideological position of we shouldn't be in the social housing market. But even then, you should still try to get some value out of what you're selling.
Yeah, I completely agree. This is just doesn't make a huge amount of sense, kind of the Liberals' approach to it. And if anything, I think it goes to show kind of that sloppiness that gets developed after 16 years in government. But they didn't do their due diligence on this. They didn't get good value for money on it. And yeah, there's really not much more to say than that.
Yeah. Auditor General Carol Bellringer concludes, governments need to have complete information about the costs, benefits, and risks it must manage when making program decisions. This is the cornerstone of evidence-based decision-making. They just want to offload these houses. And that's such a shame. And with an election coming up, it's almost, let's get rid of them before the NDP can just like grip them forever and put the government in the housing market when there are long waiting lists for these spaces. So bad news for the BC Liberals, but one of those, I think, sort of niche corner issues that unless you know someone in BC housing or following this really closely, it won't really register other than being sort of one more straw on that camel's back.
Moving on to segment two, weaving a platform. The Green Party of BC put out a whole bunch of policy this week. They've touched on agriculture policies, climate plan, and the new economy.
They've been slowly trickling big chunks of their platform out over the last week and a half, actually dating back to March 7th when they put out their Democratic Integrity section. And I think it's all in that realm of the Greens are more than just the environmental party. Every one of these sections, except maybe the Democratic Integrity bit, touches on the environment, though. So they do play to their brand because it's a strong one. People trust the Green Party on the environment, even if it's in name. But they do have a climate scientist as leader. So I do think they have a reasonable position to start from as the Greens. In their climate plan, to just sort of start getting into the nitty-gritty here, but not go through the full thing, go to the bcgreens.ca to read all these documents, and we'll have links in the show notes. They're basically going to just adopt the climate leadership team's recommendations that came out last year, I believe, which are sort of a set of policies that would help BC meet its 2030 emissions targets, which is 40% below 2007. This includes things like raising the carbon tax by $10 a year over 4 years, starting on January 1st, 2018, still keeping a fairly low carbon tax. And I think that only matches around what the federal government is calling for.
Yes, they're kind of accelerating the adoption of the federal government targets. Instead of putting off the next $10 raise of the carbon tax until 2021, when we'd have to raise it because of the federal mandate, they're doing it in 2018.
And they're also going to expand the carbon tax to fugitive emissions and slash burning forest fire emissions. Starting in 2020, they're going to find a few ways to improve efficiency in equipment, vehicles, new buildings, community planning. They're going to put some money into the understanding climate change, $30 million almost.
Yeah, the fugitive carbon tax was actually something that caught my eye when I was reading through it, in that it's a little odd that it's below the other carbon tax. I mean, kind of the whole point of a carbon tax is that all emissions matter, and if you're going to have emission X as one cost and emission Y as another, and you're pricing them differently, you know, you're not getting that same across-the-board reduction in carbon emissions, and you're also not relaying the cost of the actual emission as effectively. I mean, it's effectively a subsidy on the forest-slash-pile burning.
What's actually almost surprising for me in this climate plan is the only real action they're trying to take is sort of gradual increase of the carbon tax and some tinkering around and recommending BC Hydro be more green energy. You could argue it's part of their broader plan that will involve investments in green industry and green jobs and those kind of things. But as the climate plan itself, it's really like carbon tax, and hopefully we'll get to that emission target.
Yeah, it is a little tepid, especially following on the news out of Ottawa that there was a internal Government of Canada memo saying that we needed a $300 a ton by 2050 carbon tax to hit our climate emissions. And, you know, when you have a conservative candidate arguing for a carbon price twice what the Green Party's arguing for, you kind of got to wonder if they're not being as ambitious as they could be on this one. One of the areas they're proposing is for more efficient community design, which ties into some of their public transit targets for the carbon emission reduction. And while that's good, I do have a couple of concerns in there. For example, they will introduce a requirement for community and regional urban containment areas, you know, kind of like the Greater Toronto Area's Greenbelt, and Portland, Oregon has a similar urban growth boundary. But, you know, unless they're kind of really going to be leaning on the cities hard to also significantly increase density and counteract the economic costs from not being able to build housing on the outskirts of the city, which is only likely to exacerbate the housing issue. So I'm a little curious on how they're planning on doing that, especially in the case of local groups that can be pretty opposed to those sorts of high-density developments.
Well, we'll have to wait and see for their housing plan, which will be coming out in the next couple of weeks.
The other thing that I quite like in there is the suggestion of congestion pricing, which helps quite a bit. It's been employed quite successfully in several European cities, Singapore as well. So a good way to raise a little revenue for increased transit, which is, you know, in desperate need here in Vancouver. So yeah, there's a lot to like in here. A few kind of questionable things regarding the growth boundaries and how they're incentives. But overall, you know, pretty good in there, I think. If a little unambitious on the carbon tax.
Last month, the NDP released its climate plan, and the Greens had a very strong, wait for ours, it'll be so much better. But this is along the same lines. The NDP proposed to meet the same targets that the Climate Leadership Plan did. They proposed raising the carbon tax. The NDP was talking more about giving some of that additional carbon tax money back in rebate checks to get more households getting money back, and then investing in green jobs. This is a largely similar plan. There's, I think, a bit more hoping to nudge behaviors, let's say, promoting purchasing electric vehicles and reducing waste energy. But overall, I think you could change the header on this and change the header on the NDP plan and actually believe either is either's. Both of these took the majority of their sort of focus from the climate leadership plan, which I guess just goes to show how much good work they did, especially in building goodwill among the environmental sector in this province. When you have two major parties endorsing your report and one who says, yeah, we don't need to do anything else. It'll be interesting to see in the debates how Horgan and Weaver try to distinguish their positions on climate change, because from a 30,000 foot view, they're almost the same. And you can get into the nitty gritty and find the differences, but I think they're far more similar than they are different.
Yeah, that's probably true. But at the same time, climate change is almost certainly not going to be the ballot question. So this is kind of one of those areas you want to make sure the box is checked off and you're solid on, and it's not an area of weakness. But this is not the area you really want to distinguish yourself on.
Well, maybe where the Greens distinguish themselves on then is their agricultural plan, which came out yesterday. In there, they want to put $30 million to, quote, enhance the long-term viability of the agricultural sector, doing things like incentivizing producing food on the ALR. If we have an agricultural land reserve, which is essentially government-designated property that has to be used to grow food, we should be incentivizing growing food on that, or else why do we even have it? They're going to try and encourage more agricultural apprenticeship programs at post-secondary and really push sort of buy local initiatives. And that seems to be a trend through their whole agricultural platform, is the, you know, local food. Let's grow more food and let's eat more local food.
And that's something I'm kind of a little skeptical on, the wisdom of that. Buy local is one of those things that sounds really good in theory. But if you actually kind of look at where the numbers are with respect to emissions and energy use, transportation typically accounts for somewhere between 10 to 15% of the overall, you know, kind of field to mouth cost of agriculture. And the single biggest factor tends to be how suitable is the land for growing that particular crop. And kind of one of my favorite facts on this is it's actually greener to grow sheep in New Zealand and ship them to Britain than it is to grow sheep in Britain. That is just how much ideal climates can really help reduce the carbon footprint of agriculture. And that is a little counterintuitive, but if you're transportation costs are minor compared to actual growing costs on the environment, maybe focusing on the transportation isn't the right area to go.
Although most farmers and ranchers tend to talk about raising sheep and growing crops, but your point stands without that terminology. Other parts of the green agriculture program, like I said, try to incentivize ALRs to go for agricultural purposes. And this is something that came up in Globe and Mail investigations in the fall that we touched on, where mansions are being built on these because you can actually build much bigger houses on them than you can on like a neighboring residential zoning area because it's a big family farm. But then some of the ALR designated area is producing very tiny amounts of food to just like barely skim the bottom of the requirements. So they'll have like a fruit stand for a day, be like, we sold some food. Now we can have our mansion on this giant multi-acre plot. So cracking down on that's pretty obvious. And especially if you're in the Green Party and want to sort of bring environmental sustainability to your platform. So I don't think anyone will be fully opposed to that. Even the Liberals promised some action on that file. They're also looking to try to address the labor shortage in agriculture, which is a sort of interesting issue because I think, like I myself, grew up on a farm and left because I didn't really want to work in agriculture. I wanted to go to university and move to Vancouver and now work for nonprofits and make podcasts in my spare time. But it was a family farm, and part of the labor changes are technological. It doesn't take so many people to run a farm anymore as it used to. And parts are sort of that societal trend of urbanization.
Yeah, this strikes me as something that's kind of just a little odd, I guess, in that 100, 150 years ago, something like 80% of people or more worked in agriculture. And the reason we are so well off today is those people left agriculture, moved to the city, and found significantly more productive work there. So this kind of seems to be a step backwards almost in that respect, where the high productivity of agriculture has allowed further economic developments elsewhere, and trying to undo that seems to be counterproductive to growing the economy overall. And they want to spend some of that innovation money there we're going to be talking about shortly. You know, maybe they should be looking at ways to improve productivity and reduce the labor requirements to meet the labor supply rather than trying to up the labor supply.
I think trying to paint this as a get everyone back to the farm and back to basics is a bit of a red herring. They're more talked about labor shortages. And I don't know the labor economics of the agricultural industry that well in BC or at all. But if they say there's labor shortages, I'm assuming they're not totally making it up. What's a little bit weird about this bullet is talking about improving remuneration for agricultural workers. So that to me suggests they're just going to subsidize farmers to pay their helpers and helping hands a bit more. I know agricultural work tends to be very lowly paid, and especially if it's within the family, if it's paid at all, it's sort of under the table and below minimum wage. Alberta did a lot in this last couple of years under the NDP to really bring workers' protections to farm workers, and that caused a lot of outrage because small farms rely on sort of skirting rules and undercutting to keep in business. But at the same time, you have people put in dangerous situations, working hard and long hours. And we have labor rules for reasons to sort of keep people alive so that they can work longer and healthier and happier. It's a tough balance, and it'll be interesting to see how this plays outside of sort of Vancouver and Victoria, where the Greens will be popular, or most popular, let's say, and perhaps this agricultural plan as a whole is just going to get ignored in the Fraser Valley anyway.
One of their points in there is they're looking to expand access to farmland. You know, they point out that apparently access to farmland is a barrier to farming, which I thought kind of goes without saying, but they felt the need to identify it anyway. So they're looking to kind of expand access to farmland, and it's a little unclear on what it is. And that's something I would hope they'd flesh out a little more, because clearing land for farming is not particularly green. It's fairly emissions intensive, and I'd kind of like to see a little more on what that means in terms of expanding the access to farmland.
Well, they talk a little bit about alternatives to traditional individual land ownership, things like incubator farms, cooperatives, farmland trusts, farming on public land, backyard farming. That's how you expand it. Just let people grow wheat in their backyard. And
you
maybe
know, that worked so, because industrial stuff worked so well for the Chinese steel industry.
And maybe land sharing structures. I'm really just hoping for a sort of 5-year plan. Maybe that seems about the right time frame to expand the access to the agricultural property.
Well, something like that, you can't go wrong.
Well, we're on that joking topic then. Let's go into their new economy plan. The Greens released this on March 22nd, and it's their sort of economic new jobs approach. I know you were a big fan of the phrase innovation from the federal budget, and it's peppered throughout here. Things like sustainable enterprises, building the business environment for the new economy, having an emerging economy task force, finding more emerging opportunities.
This could have been lifted from the federal budget, and it would be hard to tell the difference in a lot of ways.
One of my favorite bullets in this entire thing is they talk about wanting to work with the federal government to develop a systematic approach to the tax system that is both progressive and neutral. So I guess they will raise taxes on the rich to cut them on the poor. That, fine, that can make sense. But it will also simplify the tax system. So usually when you get a more progressive tax system, you have more income bands, and that's not usually more simple. But this also has to achieve other government goals, such as greening the economy and promoting risk-taking and innovation, which also don't sound simple. I don't have a problem with any one of those goals, but just sort of mashing them all together as a like buzzword sandwich doesn't leave a good taste in my mouth.
Yeah, I'm skeptical this is going to actually accomplish stuff Now, I could see there's been a few sort of some areas to clean up. Some of the tax credits that mostly benefit high-income individuals. The property tax rebate, I believe it is, that the BC government hands out. You know, you could, in theory, cut that, and it would make the tax system more progressive. Now, it's hugely popular for obvious reasons, so it's politically hard to do. But there are ways you could both simplify by removing tax credits and make the system more progressive at the same time. But when you throw in everything else, yeah, it does kind of sound not well thought out.
Well, and it's big on vague platitudes and sort of short on specifics.
Oh, so it is like the federal budget.
Yeah, well, it doesn't even tell me what will my taxes be if my combined family household is $110,000 or if it's $68,000. Like, where will I sit on the income spectrum? And they said, well, we'll just work with the federal government to figure it out, which also seems very unique. Most provincial governments seem to just do their own thing on tax reform, at least. And maybe they pay attention to what the federal government is, but they don't sort of hinge their whole policy on it.
One other thing they've more or less lifted from the federal budget, or this is at the very least reminiscent of it, is they talk a lot about spending money on startup and innovation activities. So they basically want to turn the BC government into a bunch of venture capitalists as well, which, you know, I'm basically going to make the same critiques I did when the federal budget came out. And we talked about that and that, you know, is this the best use of our taxpayer money to try and prop up the stuff? You know, if these are, you know, great opportunities, surely somebody in the market's going to realize that, especially when there was just a report released that says, you know, Vancouver is one of the top cities for startups in the world. So, you know, is this the best use of money? And more specifically, are a bunch of bureaucrats and a government commission going to be better at spotting this than anyone else? And I'm very skeptical of that because the institutional incentives for, you know, bureaucrats are generally to make fairly safe, low-risk decisions. And those are generally not what you want to be doing if your goal is to stimulate innovation. Cool. And, you know, that's where, you know, somebody's kind of putting down their own money, making the kind of riskier calculations, probably going to be better at spotting those innovative opportunities than, you know, the Central Bureau of Innovation.
The one place I think they diverge a little bit from the federal government's investment strategy is in this one, it's putting the thumb a bit more on the green end of the scale. Anywhere they can highlight green energy or green technologies or anything environmental or eco-sounding, those are sort of prioritized in terms of what kind of technologies will get the funding, which, again, is on brand and fits that, but still has that downside you're talking about.
One thing I did like is that their emerging economy task force is going to be looking at stuff like, you know, ride sharing and similar things, which, you know, that overall is good, assuming they're fairly open to the idea of including these rather than just throwing up regulatory barriers to them. So overall, consider that a positive too, and definitely better than the current government. You know, we'll just kind of ignore it.
Well, and that goes hand in hand with their promise to talk about modernizing labor laws, which could throw a flag up, for me at least, when they talk about liberalizing labor laws to contribute to increased competitiveness. There's a lot of arguments to be made for a fair, responsive, and inclusive code, whatever that actually means, but simply sort of getting the labor code out of the way of companies that have a proven track record of exploiting workers as quote-unquote contractors is something that I think needs a bit more skepticism than the techno-green side might favor. And that's where the sort of centrists of the Greens and the more libertarian, almost minded environmentalists think Uber and those kind of technologies are just the solution to all our problems, when they do come with risks. And we do need to recognize that this can contribute to precarious work, which plays into the inability to afford a home and a bunch of other problems. So I'm curious to see if they'll have a broader jobs plan of how they'll make sure that people still have good labor protections and still have access to longer term jobs. Or maybe their hope is that their basic income pilot project will sort of provide the cushion under all of us when none of us have full-time jobs anymore. Finally, the first big platform the Greens really put out was their democratic integrity plank. And it contains a lot of what you'd sort of expect. The problems in BC political financing are legion, and the solutions are pretty obvious. For the Green Party, it's basically copying what Ottawa's done. They reference the Lobbying Act 2008 multiple times and just say, we'll pretty much do that in terms of have people register, put that registry online, put clear penalties if people break it. And then on the finance reform, ban non-resident BCs from donating, ban corporate and union donations, put annual limits on individual contributions, and they put those in line with the federal government as well. And don't let cabinet members engage in partisan fundraising activities while in office, and potentially ban that from all MLAs, which is actually a pretty broad ban, because one of the things MLAs do, they are still party members, they still are partisans. And so part of their job is fundraising, especially like right now, when it's not officially an election and they're still technically MLAs, but they need to be sort of raising the funds to go to the campaign.
Yeah, ministers, definitely makes sense to ban partisan fundraising activities for. And, you know, that'd be nice if the federal government would do that too. But for the, just rank and file MLA, that does seem to be a little far.
But otherwise, this is pretty much straight along the lines of what the BC NDP is also proposing. I don't know their full position on lobbying reform, but I can't imagine they're in favor of leaving it as the Wild West of Canadian politics. So overall, I'm really happy to see the Greens coming out with probably a more full platform than they've potentially ever ran on. In each of these sections, they try to put the little financial calculations of what the financial implications of what this will cost in the budget in the end. And I imagine once their full platform is out, we'll see their costing and it'll balance like everyone always does.
Well, you say that, but remember what the NDP put out in 2015? I don't think every party does that. That was more something scrawled on the back of a napkin and tried to be passed off.
It might balance, but not be auditable or real. But overall, I see this platform as being largely similar to where the BC NDP is or will be going. And going forward, this sort of how do you distinguish the two might just come down to who do you trust more. And I think what Andrew Weaver is going to have to lean on is you've seen an NDP government before. It didn't work out. What the NDP does at the national level is they say Liberal Tory, same old story. They have the Tommy Douglas story of the mouse who has to keep voting for the cats. Does he go for the white cat or the black cat? But this time he's going to elect a mouse to be prime minister. And maybe Andrew Weaver is picturing himself as the Tommy Douglas mouse now. Only it happens to be that one of the cats has the same platform as him. Well, going into our third segment, the right kind of conservative. There was a column in Maclean's this week, and it didn't set off the same firestorm as Potter's column the previous week, which is still sort of burning in the smoldering pundit class. But this was Scott Gilmore's Confessions of a South-Loathing Tory column. And this was a very heartwarming read for me as he talked about how much he hates the Conservative Party. And I can't disagree with that. But I think this more reflects sort of your position, maybe.
Yeah.
Not just because he's also named Scott.
Yeah, I posted this on my own personal Facebook page with basically the caption of more or less describes my feelings on the Conservative Party as it exists right now. And the basic theme of his piece was he's not happy with where the Conservatives are going or how they've handled themselves necessarily in the past, and highlights issues surrounding climate denial, the increasing xenophobia that seems to be emerging among a certain wing of the party, kind of the homophobic past of the Conservative Party.
And present of some...
Well, of Brad Frost. And that's, one of the areas I think they have improved on a lot. And as horrible as Kelly Leach's values proposal is, it does seem to be on the right side of the LGBT issue, or issues But overall, it highlights a lot of kind of the concerns about where the party's going and kind of that the rise of the ill-informed populist side on the, as best exemplified by Kevin O'Leary or the lingering social conservative side that Brad Frost apparently is the standard bearer of these days.
So Scott Gilmore comes from outside of politics. He has been involved in nonprofits and international aid, but he sort of has some prominence in political circles, at least because he's married to Catherine McKenna, who's ironically a liberal minister, the one for environment and climate change. But he's had a Maclean's column for a while and is always sort of identified as a conservative. So I imagine they just have like a sitcom life at home. But so he writes this column and proposes all the problems and says, I feel kind of homeless. And what are we going to do about this? Maybe we need to talk about a new conservative party or something like that. I actually really like the name New Conservative Party because then it just sort of gives a nice mirror on the New Democrat Party. Or they could even call it the New Republican Party if they became anti-monarchists, and that would be fantastic. And then in 50 years, we could have two new parties that are old. And so he's proposing dinner parties across Canada, which is the most sort of quaint conservative thing ever. He's going to have one in Ottawa, Calgary, and Vancouver, I believe.
Toronto as well.
And Toronto. Just to try to start conversations and see what people think. And I don't know how big these dinner parties are going to be, if it's just going to be like half a dozen wonks or...
From what he's posted on Twitter since this, he's gotten around 500 responses in the first day and is already looking at changing the venues for Calgary and Toronto, I believe it was, because the response was higher than he initially anticipated. And doesn't surprise me. There's kind of been a lingering discomfort with how the Conservative Party is going along a lot of the moderates.
So he's planning this for the week or month after the vote itself of the Conservative Party leadership campaign. So I think he's pretty much prejudged it that Michael Chong or a moderate's not going to win. Most of the data seems to suggest that as well. I know that doesn't give you hope, but it's sort of where it stands at iPolitics polling right now. Chong's sort of sitting in the 5% range. Not that anyone's over 20%, but I don't know how many second choices he's going to attract when the first choices are O'Leary and Leach and maybe even Bernier.
Bernier's, I actually think, is going to do pretty well on the first choice list. He's going to sweep most of the Quebec ridings, and that gives him a quarter of the points basically right there. But yeah, it's the moderate wing hasn't done as well as people would like on this one. Now, of course, that's going to depend a bit on how the vote works out with all the various ridings, and because they're weighted, and you know, if conservatives are underrepresented in the cities, but that represents a huge chunk of the ridings, the moderate kind of wing could do surprisingly well as a result. But yeah, at this moment, the data is still kind of fuzzy and hard to say, but the trend line has not been positive, I think is probably a good way to put it.
But I think the thing to throw the most cold water on this entire conversation is just that it's not actually easy to get a new political party going. Like, on paper it is. You could have a new political party formed probably in 2 or 3 days to just file the paperwork. But then you'd be sitting with the Progressive Party, which is a thing, and the Animal Liberation Party and these other sort of fringe things you've never heard about, or probably like the Sex Party, which I think is still here in BC. But so to get the level of serious strategy and vision for it takes sort of having the key influencers and having the networks that you're not just a fringe person right away. And Scott Gilmore's not a fringe person. He's got some connections, so he's maybe not the perfect person to start it. You might want, ideally, I'd say, a couple sitting MPs would be perfect.
This would be looking to kind of probably draw away that old PC portion of the current Conservative Party, and they'd be the ones, you know, you probably need a few defections before it kind of really picks up steam.
And I think the bigger trend working against it is there's no regional core for this. So because of the way our first-past-the-post system works, to really do well with a new political party, you need to sort of do like Reform did and start with a bunch of pissed-off Westerners who sit in Alberta and Saskatchewan and sort of the interior BC and go, we have no voice in Ottawa. Now we can form as a region. Or like the Bloc Québécois, who at the same time were a bunch of pissed off Quebecers who went, Ottawa's not listening to us. We're going to form our own party. And then you have that sort of very tight regional base. So even if you only have 5 to 10% of the national vote, you can still get seats. What sort of killed the Progressive Conservatives was they had a good amount of support, but it was across the entire country, sort of spread out like butter on toast. And that meant they lost to the NDP in some ridings. They lost to the Reform in others. They lost to the Liberals in other ridings. And in the end, they got two seats in Atlantic Canada, where there were some perfectly defined as Progressive Conservative ridings left. But that was it.
Yeah, and actually Atlantic Canada is probably be where they do fairly well, at least initially. Maybe the 905 too. Because, yeah, like Peter McKay's old riding that went Liberal for like the first time in, I don't know how many terms, but a long time. It's been pretty solidly conservative area. And yeah, the Atlantic Canada always was kind of on the PC side of the equation rather than the Reform. That does kind of present some problems because you probably have a fair number of conservatives stuck in, you know, the cities and whatnot to kind of fall more into that PC mold, but there's just not enough of them in any one riding to kind of get the boost you'd need to actually get MPs into office. So yeah, it does present some challenges, and there's, you know, some lingering concerns about, you know, splitting the right and going back to the 90s where two right-wing parties were permanently in opposition because they couldn't collectively get enough votes to unseat the Liberals.
Well, I was just going to say, that's why I wish this movement the absolute best of luck, and hopefully we can have a perpetually split right. The electoral math isn't so simple. Well, as we've sort of seen in Alberta, you can promise to unite the right and then piss a whole bunch of people off when you, like Jason Kenney, apparently go into the Calgary Herald newsroom and say schools should out gay kids to their parents, which was just its own level of tone deafness. But we'll leave Jason Kenney in a corner to think about what he's done and let celebrities like Katie Lang keep asking him if he's gay, which is the rumor going around, because you can only ask him when he's promising to out gay kids.
So yeah, there's definitely some viability concerns here, and I'm not sure if it's going to go anywhere. And you know, there's also some lingering skepticism just because of who Scott Gilmore's wife is. I think it would put a lot more people more at ease if this wasn't coming from the husband of a Liberal cabinet minister who would stand to benefit from a split right. But at the same time, like this, there's some interest there, and there does seem to be an increasing number of disaffected Tories with that kind of how the party's going. And with the leadership still underway and that not sorted out yet, you know, it's a little early to be writing the eulogy for the United Conservative movement, but there's definitely some tension that has come to the surface recently, and I could see if it gets really bad, especially if someone like Kevin O'Leary or Kelly Leach wins. You know, there could be fairly big division forming as a result. So it's going to be interesting to see where this goes, and I was one of the 500 or so who put my name down on that, so I'm kind of curious to see where it goes, and I'll be interested to see what happens at that dinner party in June.
And if we get the chance, we'll try and get Scott Gilmore on the show and get his thoughts directly. Well, moving into our quick takes, the first sort of big news this week that wasn't actually that much substance was that the CBC has learned from an anonymous source that we can expect a marijuana legalization bill in the next couple weeks, and that the Trudeau Liberals' goal is to have pot legal by July 1st, 2018, because I guess Canada's birthday is a great day to get stoned. The leak suggests that the government is going to largely follow the marijuana task force recommendations that came out a few months ago, and they're really going to kick a lot of the nitty-gritty details down to the provinces. So how pot's distributed and sold and what age ranges can buy it will all be decided on a province-by-province basis, just like alcohol.
Yeah, which has, you know, people in Ontario who have to deal with Kathleen Wynne and the LCBO not exactly happy about this.
And one of the other big rules they released is that there'll probably be a maximum of 4 personal plants that you can grow in your household for personal consumption. This all takes place against the backdrop where there were a few raids in the last week in Ontario, I think in Toronto specifically, where dispensaries are being raided because they are operating illegally. It's not happening in BC because our Attorney General doesn't really care. It makes more sense to spend police resources on things other than the dispensaries. But that just sort of highlights the hypocrisy of still keeping it illegal while talking about how it will be legal in the future and still criminalizing and arresting people. There have been things they could have done to sort of put it in a, all right, we're going to sort of decriminalize temporarily until we've brought in new laws.
Yeah, exactly. There's no reason you couldn't have done a decriminalization measure in the first sitting after the election while you figure everything out. Especially because one of the election pitches is, you know, people shouldn't be tarred for life with these, you know, criminal records for having a few joints on them or something. So to see them continue on with it, just is a little baffling.
So we'll dive in more when the full text of the bill is out and people start to debate it.
Hey, moving on, we got some polling about how the federal budget landed, and the results are not good. So overall, only 14% of people approve, and 40% disapprove, and interestingly enough, 36% have no opinion and 10% don't know, which is seems to be split in hairs a little bit on that one.
Guess you have to ask both ways because people could have read it and then not cared. And then other people, 10% didn't know there was a budget, which actually seems like a very low number. I usually think the political non-participation rate, if that's a thing, the number of people who don't follow politics is much higher than I'd say 10%. Maybe that's why people got confused by these answers and 36% also have no opinion because they didn't know there was a budget. The people most likely to support the budget, unsurprisingly, are Liberals. But even there, only 31% of Liberal supporters support the budget. They didn't put in the headlines the disapprove level among Liberals. The other sympathizers were stereotypical Liberal voters, as it were. People in Atlantic Canada at 20% and people with postgraduate degrees also at 20%. None of which are that good of numbers. Obviously, conservative voters, people living in Alberta, those are the people who don't like the budget, but they're never going to like the budget, just like Liberal voters probably didn't like Conservative Party budgets. It's partisanship. They went through as well in this poll on lots of different issues and saw what people thought of getting rid of the Canada Savings Bond. No one cares because no one has a Canada Savings Bond anymore. The scrapping transit credit was fairly unpopular, though. Potentially just because as soon as you say we're going to stop giving you a tax credit for transit, people get angry, even if they don't necessarily know that they had it or used it or even got much back for it. But the government did get some hits on childcare investments and parental leave. And so all that data is in Forum's poll, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes. But overall, it was, I guess, pretty bad news for the Liberals.
Yeah, it basically confirms the vast majority of the punditry out there that it was just meh.
Well, speaking of bad news, today the RCMP announced that there's going to be a special prosecutor appointed to investigate the BC campaign financing scandals. This relates back to the Globe and Mail's investigation a couple weeks ago, where they found that lobbyists were donating on behalf of companies, which breaks the one of the maybe two campaign finance rules we actually have. And Elections BC passed the investigation to the RCMP, and now the RCMP have appointed a special prosecutor, because you don't want a sort of government-appointed person or someone with ties to the government investigating the government during an election campaign. So on the one hand, this seems sort of just like what you would do, but also special prosecutors are never a like non-story, I think.
Yeah, that's never a good thing to have happen, and it's really not a good thing just at the start of an election. So we're just going to have to see what happens with this, but it's clearly not good news at Liberal Party headquarters. Well, speaking of news, the City of Vancouver is catching a little flack for massively expanding their communications staff. Since Vision Vancouver took over, they've added 33 communication workers including 12 managers and 7 public engagement officers. And the cost of the city communication staff has jumped from $600,000 under the NPA to $2.3 million.
And that's $2.3 million for the 21 of 33 people that the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, who put this report together, were able to account. So it's probably a little bit bigger than that anyway. Some of them might be lower paid staff who wouldn't be on sunshine lists. Vision Vancouver tries to justify this, and I think you can make a good argument that communications now is much more nuanced and complicated than it was the sort of decade ago before Vision's time. Of course, it never looks good when you're spending money on people whose sole job is to essentially spin and sell your message. But it can also be something you can talk about important when you talk about public engagement officers. If the city is just kind of doing its own thing, it will also be criticized. So you can argue that paying someone to go and get feedback is an important tool, provided it's done in this sort of unbiased way, which it's hard to measure. The other thing I'll push back here is this is the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, who just love to sort of find center or center-left governments and just count every dollar they've spent and went, look at that. I think they're the ones who drive around with the debt clock, and they talk about being for taxpayers, but really their board is, I think, their entire membership, and it's about 3 or 4 people. So they don't represent everyone. Let's just put that out there. That doesn't mean their numbers are wrong. I think they generally get them right. They just sort of come from a very particular point of view.
Yeah, I think this is one of those things that's kind of got little traction to it, just because it kind of plays to the narrative, which is kind of that Greta Robertson's does a lot to kind of appear, you know, very engaged and progressive and whatnot, but kind of not much has really happened on a lot of the important files that's kind of been around his desk. And, you know, who can forget the pledge to end homelessness by 2015? And, you know, nothing big's happened on that. So I think this kind of goes to the typecast, I guess, of the Vision government, that they're very appearance-focused. They're not necessarily getting the policy stuff done that people want.
Speaking of things people don't want, Leah McLaren has been in the news this last week for a column that briefly went up on the Globe and Mail talking about how she one time at a party tried to breastfeed Michael Chong's baby, which
is weird enough as it normally, but the fact that she wasn't, you know, lactating at the time or anything else,
and this was had a weird urge at this party.
Yeah.
And that's all weird enough. And there is something called the like co-feeding movement, where it's consensual adults who feed one another's babies just to make sure the babies get enough milk. And that's fine, I think, and its own. But the key word there is consent, like, and knowledge, and not just this weird, like, I found a baby, I'm going to put it into my boob. All right, so that's all weird. And Chong says, all right, this did happen, but I don't really want to talk about it's odd, no doubt. But where this really gets weird is, why did she feel the need to tell the world this story and write it as a Globe and Mail column? The Globe says it was, quote, accidentally posted online, or at least one source told the Toronto Star. But, like, there are stories that you just have that you go, you know, I'm going to keep that to myself. Or I'll, you know, tell it at a joke when I'm at a party, but I won't publish that in a national newspaper column, right? So McLaren's now been suspended from the Globe and Mail, and this just broke today, which just also goes to show that the Globe and Mail will suspend you for telling a weird baby breastfeeding story and not for repeatedly plagiarizing other materials.
Yeah, well, I just want to know, you know, why is Michael Chong the one attracting all of these weird stories? It was this, it was the Guatemalan bathroom thing. Like, you gotta feel bad for the guy. Like the man exuded substance, and yet somehow all of his big media hits are all these weird little stories that just kind of percolate up to the surface that he has, you know, no control over and really doesn't do anything for his campaign or get at what he's talking about.
Kind of makes me hope he does win the leadership and then prime ministership, just to like hear all the weird things that will trickle out over 4 or 8 years or whatever. Like some embarrassing story to deal with, like the German prime minister, or like awkward things that could come out. And that just reminds me, if you want to hear a great random story of political intrigue. Check out the last Boys in Short Pants, where Etienne tells his, like, pen story and it involves French diplomats, and it was the most random thing I've ever heard. So definitely listen to that.
So the Liberal government's checks are starting to roll out for some of their strategic investments and innovation funding, and one of the first recipients is for Canada, where the federal government is putting $100 million into an engine plant they have there, as well as investing in some AI research with Ford. And I criticized them a lot on our budget episode for throwing money at this, but the reason I want to bring it up is, if the government's going to be throwing out a carbon tax on stuff, why are they subsidizing a gasoline engine manufacturing facility? Like, isn't this at cross purposes with one of their other kind of big planks?
So this is a match dollar for dollar with the Ontario government. So Kathleen Wynne gets just as much criticism here. The Ontario government in this is talking about how this is going to create 300 new jobs and protect hundreds more, which seems like a pretty high cost per job. But in terms of the hypocrisy of investing in gas-guzzling Fords at the same time as trying to cut climate change, it sounds about the same level of hypocrisy as investing in tanks for Saudi Arabia at the same time as trying to promote a new approach to human rights globally. That's not to say either are the right thing to do, but it's consistent. Along the same lines, Bombardier's back in the news as they've announced that their top five exec are going to be taking basically a 50% pay raise this year. And this accounts to basically $33 million US going to their senior executives, as lots of their staff are being laid off and they continue to seek government aid. Last month, the federal government gave them $370 million loan to kickstart some of these programs, but it seems like that's just going into the pockets of the exec.
You just got to ask, like, if we are going to be shelling up for corporate welfare, should we? Why the hell is it going into executive compensation, of all places? But I think particularly galling is Trudeau, without irony, suggested that the government respects free market and the choices company makes. Which, you know, if he did, he wouldn't be shoveling tons of money into a well-connected Quebec company that consistently loses money. You either respect free markets or you give corporate welfare to companies that then pad the executive bonuses, but you don't do both. And that's been Politicoast. Find links to the stories we mentioned in the show notes at politicoast.ca. Make sure to subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at PoliticoastPod. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. And if you have any ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Thanks for listening.
And here's to another 6 months.